Enjoy the rest of your vacation.
Yes, definitely,
thank
Amelia.
You.
Get day drunk. Thanks.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. As we reported last Friday, the Mueller investigation is over. And on Sunday, we got our first glimpse at its findings in a letter from Attorney General Bill Barr to the Judiciary Committee that was made public. The four-page letter was a summary of the investigation's principal findings, according to Barr, and it stated what we've known for some time, that Russia interfered in the 2016 election by spreading disinformation online and hacking Clinton campaign and Democratic Party computers. The letter also quoted directly from Mueller's report that, quote, the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. End quote. The Mueller report was more ambivalent about whether the president obstructed justice, with another direct quote reading, quote, while the report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also doesn't exonerate him. Barr also wrote that he and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein concluded separately from the Mueller report that Trump did not obstruct justice. So today we're going to break down what these conclusions mean legally and politically. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going well, Galen.
Senior politics writer, Clay Malone. How's it going?
It's good.
Fabulous. And managing editor, Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very good.
And also joining us again from California is 538 contributor and legal reporter, Amelia Thompson DeVoe. Hey, Amelia.
Hey, Galen.
Amelia, of course, is still on vacation. I can't imagine a better way to spend a vacation than with the 538 Politics podcast. So thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
All right, let's begin with you, Amelia. What can we conclude about Mueller's findings from Attorney General Barr's summary?
There are two sort of main pieces here, and the first is that Mueller didn't find any evidence, as you mentioned, that the Trump campaign, President Trump, people in his orbit illegally coordinated or conspired with the Russian government in their 2016 election interference. So that's a big deal. That's a pretty sort of conclusive, clean bill of health for Trump and people close to him when it comes to election interference. Mueller actually didn't come to a conclusion on the other piece of this, which is obstruction of justice. He sort of, in the report, laid out evidence on both sides, seemed like it was sort of a tricky call and left it up to Barr and Rosenstein to make the actual prosecutorial decision to say, you know, there's enough evidence here to warrant obstruction of justice charges or not. So that's sort of an interesting piece. Like, what we're getting from Barr's summary is not just what Mueller concluded, but also what Barr and Rosenstein decided after reading Mueller's report. So it's sort of being filtered through a couple layers.
We're going to spend much of this podcast up front talking about the legal issues in Barr's letter, but I also just out of the gate want to get reactions from you guys here at the table. Nate, Claire, Micah, what did you find notable in Barr's letter?
I mean, look, part of analyzing the story the whole time has been the difference between taking stock of what you've known all along or the accumulated knowledge versus like the flow of what news happens to break on any given day. So, you know, a big part of the Mueller report, apparently, and we should say this is Barr's summary of it, and maybe there'll be some material differences, maybe not. The first part of it is devoted to demonstrating that Russia did attempt to hack the 2016 election. I'm not one of those people who thinks this hack was as influential as it could be, but there were certainly serious efforts on the part of the Russian government to interfere in our election, right? And so it's important, I think, to say that when we're kind of looking over the scope of what the report claimed. Yeah, look, I mean, there was not a lot of material directly quoted from the report, and so the kind of two lines that stood out were, in the first instance, the line kind of saying that there was no coordination. Here's how we define coordination. Maybe there are some caveats, some weasel words buried in there. Maybe not. We should probably see the full report, right? But seemed like a reasonably unequivocal denial of that something reached this coordination threshold. And then second, the refusal to say that Trump did not commit obstruction of justice, and for Mueller to kind of go out of his way to say does not exonerate, knowing that material might be quoted, was interesting. And so, I don't know, you know, I mean, I kind of thought of it as like, if you do put aside the fact that they are saying that Russia did try to hack the election, which if you're like some pundit who was like, oh no, there was nothing to this, then that you should probably take that into account. But to me, it's like, if zero was the worst possible outcome for Trump and 10 was the best one, it's like a 7.5 for Trump, because you get a 10 on the collusion and a 5 on the obstruction or something.
Yeah, obviously the second part, the obstruction of justice part, is the interesting one. And I'm there's sort of two things on that that I immediately thought about. One was the fact that Mueller, for lack of a better word, punted on kind of giving an official yay or nay on obstruction. And he left it to Barr and Rosenstein, kind of knowing, I think, that they would exonerate Trump from that obstruction of justice charge. And now it comes to this kind of messy field of political play, which I won't get into too much here. But that sentence that Barr does quote from Mueller saying it doesn't totally exonerate Trump, or, you know, he's not totally free from wrongdoing, perhaps. That's interesting. And I think a lot of people have brought up, and I kind of wanted to ask Amelia this, the fact that the president only ever submitted written answers and never was actually interviewed by Mueller face to face. I'm kind of curious about that and whether or not in the coming days that will become, you know, something that Democrats will hinge on to say, listen, we didn't know actually the mindset of Trump. And so the obstruction is obviously the interesting part here now.
Although as far as the president of the United States is concerned, speculation about whether or not he had coordinated or conspired with Russia in its meddling in the 2016 election had colored his presidency from day one. And now
but that's not the part that I'm interested in, because I think it was always pretty, the Russia collusion part from the beginning was always a thin line between criminal or stupid, you know, in the sort of shorthand of it. And now Mueller's kind of giving it officially like it was sort of a disorganized campaign and like they didn't know what they were doing. I think the interesting question.
Well,
I wasn't talking about the Russia part. I was saying that I think it'll be interesting to see in the coming days what people say about, well, why wasn't Mueller ever interviewing Trump face to face about the obstruction stuff, right? Going on national TV and saying, this is why I fired Comey. That I think is, but yes, you're right, obviously, that this is a big half shadow lifted from him, right? Because he still might have to parry stuff from Democrats, but the fact that he can say, listen, yeah, I'm not Putin's stooge, that's a big deal.
Yeah. The headline here is no collusion. That's the headline here. There are other sort of like decks here, or what do they call them in newspapers? Subheads.
Mike, you know full well.
But the headline here is no collusion. The thing, though, is, and where I balk a little bit about the with like shadow over his presidency language, is I think most fair-minded people thought the chances of collusion were relatively small. I think there was some evidence pointing in that direction, the Trump Tower meeting, some of Trump's own behavior, but just the chances that there would be a conspiracy proven in a conspiracy in like how most Americans define it, I think were relatively low. They weren't zero, which is why we had an investigation. But Mueller's charter was like, did Russia interfere? Did Trump collude with that interference? And then, you know, you can look into anything that came out of that. So the fact that Trump did not collude by this definition is important. I just don't think it was a shadow hanging over his presidency. I don't think you saw a lot of Democrats running on collusion in 2018. I don't think you see collusion show up as like a big factor in people's opinions of Trump in polling. So I just don't think it's going to like all of a sudden change the trajectory of.
I think someone had a really good line last week on Twitter before the Mueller report came out, and they said, if you've been watching MSNBC, you're probably in for a bit of a shock when the report comes out, no matter what, because that there is a certain, I think, skew of liberal that was placing a lot on Mueller.
I mean, to me, the Russia investigation was this subplot that you don't care for very much in this TV show that you like. Now, this is a little selfish because for us, we think this is one of the hardest stories for us to talk about, given our strengths as a news organization. And by the way, I think that applies to most news organizations, unless you are like the Times or the Post or maybe CNN or something where you actually have deep ties within the intelligence community and whatever else, right?
ABC News.
For everyone else, you're left to chew on a relatively limited set of facts, and that leads to endless speculation and second guessing. And because it's kind of not our bailiwick, you know, we kind of probably did less of it than other people, and that gave us kind of less of an opportunity to get ourselves in trouble. But it was not, I think, very present from day to day. If you look at kind of what voters actually say are the most important issues, if you look at what people were campaigning on in 2018, if you look at what Democrats are campaigning on in 2020, there's not a major emphasis on Russiagate. I'm not sure I buy that, like, it's not going to have any effect on Trump's approval ratings, because, like, there is a narrative here. I think it will affect how the press frames him. I think the press still feels like, oh my gosh, you know, we missed Trump in 2016, and now we have to make sure we, you know, because there had been, after the midterms, this tendency in the press to portray Trump more negatively and kind of to imply that his presidency was a failure. I think that will change now, and this is one of the major episodes of the presidency. I don't know. I'm going to make a very weird analogy.
Go for it.
Because it happened at roughly the same point in the presidency. This is a very weird analogy. I'm sure you're all going to send me hate mail. In terms of, like, the political impact, it reminds me a little bit of when Osama bin Laden was killed. And
Okay.
In the sense that, like, that was literally part of Obama's closing argument in 2012. And maybe it helped him at the margin, right? He did win re-election. But, you know, literally kind of the sum total of a lot of focus of American foreign policy was the destruction wrought by Osama bin Laden. And then it happens, and it is like a big deal, but it kind of becomes, at the end, once it gets out of the news, kind of like one bullet point in a list of 12 or 13 reasons why Obama would say he should be reelected, and maybe one of the more compelling bullet points, right? But things look a lot differently in the rearview mirror than they do in the present tense.
All right, we're going to get more into the politics in a little bit, but while we have Amelia here, so Amelia, we only got a 4-page summary from Barr, who was, of course, appointed by Trump, as we all know. What do we still not know about the Mueller report?
Oh, well, I mean, we don't have access to what Mueller actually wrote up at this point. And so what we're, you know, as the Democrats have been very eager to point out, what we are relying on is what Barr concluded based on what Mueller wrote and sort of what Barr thought was important. I mean, I think in terms of the sort of Russian interference stuff, we already going into this had a very good sense of what was probably going to go into Mueller's report, just because his charging documents have been so detailed. And Perry and I wrote a piece sort of outlining what we knew from those charging documents a few months ago, you know, basically saying Mueller has been kind of outlining the depth and scope of this interference for quite some time now. So that, you know, I think maybe there's stuff in the Mueller report that wasn't in those charging documents. Maybe there wasn't, you know, but I think we have a pretty good sense for that. In terms of the other evidence he's collected, I mean, we just have what Barr wrote to go on. And now there's going to be a big fight, both for the contents of Mueller's report. And then also Democrats in Congress actually also want all of the underlying materials from the report. So not just what Mueller had to summarize to the Department of Justice under the special counsel regulations, which was basically, these are the people I indicted and why, these are, you know, any decisions not to indict that I made and why, but like all of his interviews, all of the documents that he got. So that is a massive amount of information, and the Democrats are going to be trying to get it.
Can I ask a question about, okay, so we've got in Barr's summary of the report where he says, you know, Mueller outlines evidence on both sides of the obstruction question. What do you think those arguments, what could that give to Democrats? Like, obviously this is, you know, you have never seen the report, but what sorts of things would Democrats be looking for there? What sort of threads of argumentation would they be looking for from the Mueller report?
Amelia, what's in the Mueller report?
No.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
So, guys, I know what's in the Mueller report, and I've just been holding out. No, obviously, we have no idea. So I think this is tricky for Democrats, because one of the hard things about the obstruction thing always has been that a lot of this potentially obstructive behavior we've seen. You know, it was Trump tweeting that if he had known that Attorney General or former Attorney General Jeff Sessions was going to recuse himself from the Mueller investigation, he wouldn't have appointed him. And, you know, he's saying, going on national television and talking about why he fired James Comey. And that's challenging for obstruction of justice because there's sort of, you know, one of the things that is required for obstruction of justice is you have to have a corrupt intent. And there's been this question of, well, if Trump has been doing all of this publicly, if he's just been tweeting, is that really evidence of corrupt intent? Normally people hide that. So, you know, there was, I think there's just a lot of ambiguity in Barr's summary about whether there is actually information we don't already know in this summary of evidence. If there is information we don't know, you know, let's say having to do with Trump's sort of actions within the executive branch, stuff that wasn't like happening on his Twitter profile, you know, that could potentially be useful for Democrats. But I think, you know, there's some risk here that if they make a big play to get this part of the Mueller report released, and there could be a big fight over what's covered by executive privilege and then might not be released, that it could just be, you know, basically what we already know. And it's sort of Mueller saying, is this obstruction? Is this not obstruction? There's sort of evidence on both sides for it. And then obviously Barr and Rosenstein read that and they say, no, we don't think this warrants obstruction charges.
I think Amelia makes a really good point, which is I think a lot of Democrats looked at that both sides of the equation language and thought, oh, there's a lot of stuff in this Mueller report that'll give us ammunition. And as Amelia says, it's possible that the stuff on the Trump obstructed side is just the public stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's continue our conversation with Amelia in a moment. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. Yet most of us aren't doing it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. A built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides, helping guide a full and even clean. Up to 90% of us don't brush for a full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly. Quip doesn't require a clunky charger and runs for 3 months on one charge. And Quip is backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/538 right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip, getquip.com/538, the numbers, not the letters. Getquip.com/538. All right, let's continue our conversation with Amelia. Just to clarify, what is the legal standard for charging somebody with obstruction of justice? What were the things that Rod Rosenstein and Bill Barr were considering when they made that decision not to charge?
A lot of it has to do with motive, whether there was corrupt intent to obstruct justice. And when I talked to legal experts about this, that was one of the things that they identified as sort of a potentially high bar for prosecutors here, and then also sort of in general, because it's hard to prove intent. And again, when all of this stuff is happening in public, I think this is one of the things that's sort of been interesting about Trump throughout his presidency, right, is that he's just more willing to do things in public that, you know, other people might not do. And so as I was talking to legal experts about this obstruction of justice issue, several people said to me that the fact that, you know, this behavior has just been happening in the public eye might sort of make it more difficult for a prosecutor to consider it to be obstruction of justice, just because, you know, if someone's doing it in public and not hiding it.
Boorish transparency.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's again, with his sort of firing people, like firing someone like James Comey, it's kind of like he can just say, well, you know, I fire people. So, you know, I think that was always basically, from a legal perspective, that was always going to be a really high bar to clear. So I wasn't surprised, at least when I saw that this was not something that Barr and Rosenstein thought there was enough evidence for.
I saw someone say that it turns out Nixon's mistake was not doing it just everything publicly.
But what about the thread of argumentation that says, okay, well, let's look at the first half of the report. There was no crime, so he couldn't have obstructed a crime that didn't exist. Can you maybe walk people through that?
Tell that to Martha Stewart.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, you can still commit obstruction of justice even if there isn't an underlying crime. I think that, you know, the question here is just sort of, you know, was Trump just being Trump, or was he acting more sort of directly and maliciously to undermine the investigation?
You know, one thing that's not clear to me based on Barr's summary, and I don't know if Amelia has an answer to this or not, is the scope of collusion that was under investigation. I mean, my understanding is that Mueller concludes that Trump was not directly involved or even tacitly involved with, like, efforts to hack, for example, the DNC emails, or efforts to, like, troll everyone on social media, which, if I understand, is the scope that Mueller focuses on in the report per Barr. That doesn't mean that Trump couldn't have other Russia dealings that weren't problematic, so particularly over the dealings in Trump Tower, whether there was a quid pro quo there or whether there were other financial ties. And so that seems pertinent to me, that Trump could have reason to fear an investigation into Russia stuff, and that might lead to some obstruction and or might lead to Trump trying to threaten people to stay within scope. Maybe Trump is smarter than people are giving him credit for, and he knew that there was, like, no evidence of collusion in this important but relatively narrow sense, but that if you start investigating the stuff that Michael Cohen is going to jail for lying to Congress about, then it gets into much murkier territory.
So not having seen the report, I don't want to speculate too much, but I do think, you know, it seems like what Barr is talking about in this summary is fairly narrow, insofar as Mueller, you know, again, according to Barr, is apparently saying, okay, we did not find evidence that Trump or someone on his campaign said, yes, Russia, let's interfere with the election in one of the ways that Russia ultimately interfered with the election. You know, it's not, I mean, for example, they seemed excited to accept the sort of, or to have the benefits of Russia interfering. You know, you have someone, you have Trump saying, Russia, find those emails. That's not a criminal conspiracy. So, at least based on what Barr wrote, it is a fairly narrow scope. And I think we've gotten the sense that Mueller has seen his project in this investigation as being kind of narrowly confined to Russian interference in the 2016 election, and then did Americans conspire or coordinate in that effort. I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons that Trump could have not wanted to be investigated, and it's hard to say exactly what Mueller found, what Mueller has referred out of this investigation. But, you know, I do think we can probably guess, based on Barr's summary, at least if Barr's summary is accurate, that this is sort of fairly narrowly focused on 2016.
Yeah, there is a part of me that feels a little bit like so much of this was really narrowly defined in terms of Mueller's mandate, in terms of the bar for obstruction, the bar for collusion, the definition of collusion, and also just that, like, the DOJ guidance is you can't indict a president. So, like, was this sort of like a fait accompli to some extent?
A sound and fury signifying nothing?
Well, that was my other question for Amelia. Is like, okay, Amelia, there are a lot of people dunking on the media today, some of which is, in my view, fair, and a lot of which isn't fair. But as someone you've spent, you know, the past 2 years really focused on the, like, nitty gritty of this investigation, where I've been mostly focused on, like, the politics of it. So what has your impression of, like, the wider coverage, not only about the nitty gritty, but about how it affects Trump's presidency? You know, I know the media is, like, a nebulous term that encapsulates everything, but do you feel like the media or parts of the media today should be looking in the mirror and be like, okay, where did we go wrong here? Or were the do you think, outside of maybe a couple of mistakes or bad actors, the media writ large did okay in this case?
Well, I just think this was a really, you know, this has been a hard investigation to cover for the reasons that we were discussing. And I think without kind of seeing the report and understanding the full context, which, I mean, you know, let's be clear, like there's a very good chance this full report is never made public and we never know exactly how Robert Mueller laid all of this out. So I'll say I was also always kind of in the camp of, I think the kind of coordination conspiracy stuff is unlikely, that we're unlikely to kind of get a report that says, yes, the Trump campaign, you know, someone from the Trump campaign said to Russia, like, yes, let's do this. And that was going to be a conclusion of the report. You know, I think maybe there's an argument to be made that sort of the coverage of the report made a result like that seem more plausible. I think that very much depends on the kind of coverage you're looking at. But, you know, I think the other challenge with this investigation is that, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at, and again, this kind of goes back into the political dimensions of this, but views of this investigation have gotten so partisan anyway that I just think that also added a sort of layer to it where people's expectations and people's beliefs about this, I think, have kind of gotten much further from sort of what we could reasonably have expected the investigation to yield. And so that's why I was actually, you know, I was a little surprised yesterday when I saw that the summary had actually given the Democrats more ammunition than I thought they were going to get to demand the full report. Yeah, but I think overall, this has just been a challenging investigation to cover. And mostly, I think people have done okay in doing that. But again, you know, it's not over yet. There's now going to be this big fight to get the actual report and the materials. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah, Amelia, what does that fight look like? You said we may never see the contents of the Mueller report. What are the steps between now and finding out what we do ultimately get to see?
DOJ is and Attorney General Barr are now sort of going through, and Barr said in this letter, trying to figure out what they can release. And there are, you know, a lot of different things that could keep various parts of the report from being released. There could be information that is classified or confidential. Prosecutors in general are discouraged from releasing information that, you know, isn't necessarily, like, isn't directly related to a criminal investigation, sort of offering reasoning. And then there's the issue of executive privilege, which covers basically deliberations between the president and advisors and agency deliberations. And that could be relevant potentially to the obstruction of justice piece. So I think what will probably happen is DOJ will move forward in sort of saying, you know, this is what we can release to Congress. And then Congress, the House Democrats, will make a determination about, you know, do we want to issue a subpoena? Do we want to call Barr to come testify about his deliberations in determining, for example, that there wasn't sufficient evidence for obstruction of justice? Do we, you know, they want to say they want to get the underlying materials? So there are a lot of ways that this fight could drag out, and it could very easily end up in the courts and in a fight.
Who physically has a copy of the Mueller report? Only Barr?
Yeah, I mean, Barr definitely has it. Yeah, I don't know who else would have that at this point. I don't think the White House has said that they've gotten it.
If you have a copy of the Mueller report, please send us a note.
147 Columbus Avenue, New York, New York.
Actually, is that illegal to?
No, I don't care. I probably ABC Standards will yell at us, and this will be the last edition of this podcast. If you have a copy of the Mueller report, please send it to 147 Columbus Avenue, New York, New York. What's our zip code here?
You're encouraging people to commit
10023.
10023.
Is that it, I think? Okay, well, I think we're going to wrap up here with you, Amelia. But as we say goodbye, ultimately, Mueller did indict people in Trump's orbit for lying throughout this investigation. Like, what was all of that about if there was no crime? Is that going to continue to be a strain of investigation beyond the Mueller investigation?
I do wonder in like your typical cases, you cut deals with lower level people because you think you can get higher level people. So in this case, you do wonder a little bit about why was Mueller cutting all those deals? I offered this total speculation that maybe this is a weird case where proving a negative, or, you know, proving, quote unquote, a negative is really valuable because it's the president of the United States. So you cut deals to get at whether Trump colluded, whether or not you think he did, and whether or not there's evidence that he did, because knowing that is such of such value to the country.
It is noteworthy that, like, the scope of this investigation was somewhat contained, and that it's not a kind of Star thing where you keep investigating and investigating until you find some objectionable conduct, which, you know, surely there might be, even if it was pretty far removed from this initial mandate that Mueller had. You know, you might think that would trigger, like, a little bit more modesty from people on Trump's side saying, hey, look, he stayed within scope. This is a big deal that he found no collusion. People built up to this for a long time, but, like, stopping short of saying this is a complete and total vindication, this was a witch hunt, whatever else, it seems like it wasn't a witch hunt because a witch hunt might have delved more into Trump Tower, Moscow, or whatever else.
Yeah, but Amelia, to get back to the final question here, I mean, why ultimately were people in Trump's orbit lying, and then why was Mueller cutting deals with them after they did lie?
So I'm not going to speculate about why they were lying, because I think that's one of the big questions that I have. And we just don't know at this point why all of those people were lying. I do think this is an important reminder in terms of the deals that were cut for some of these people in Trump's orbit, that they've been assisting with other investigations and are actually continuing to. Rick Gates in particular is still cooperating with prosecutors. And, you know, there was always sort of a question about, are they cooperating with something directly related to the Mueller investigation, or are they helping with some other unrelated investigation? Michael Flynn seems to have been cooperating on a number of different investigations that were sort of completely outside the scope of what Mueller was doing. And so that's, I think, going to be something interesting to keep an eye on, just what's happening with these other investigations. I'm curious in, you know, what kinds of information Rick Gates is providing and to whom. But I think, you know, there have sort of been these kind of offshoots and tentacles from the Mueller investigation, and those are not ending just because Mueller is sort of wrapping up and will soon be turning out the lights. So, you know, maybe we haven't really seen the end of all of these threads.
All right, and with that note of suspense, we're going to let Amelia go and then spend a little more time talking about the politics of Mueller's conclusion. So, Amelia, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Happy to do it.
Enjoy the rest of your vacation.
Yes, definitely,
thank
Amelia.
You.
Get day drunk.
All right. Thanks.
All right, and before we get into the politics further, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. And that place is ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a match. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's podcast is also brought to you by SimpliSafe. Alarm, the willies, the heebie-jeebies, panic, there are dozens of words for fear. But just one for an exceptional home security company to stop fear at your front door. SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe is home security that knows it feels good to fear less. It's award-winning 24/7 protection that protects your home through it all, through blizzards, blackouts, and burglars. SimpliSafe has won awards from all the tech experts that count. The Verge calls it the best home security. It won Reader's Choice from PC Magazine. And it's a 2-time winner of CNET Editor's Choice and a Wirecutter top pick. SimpliSafe has no contract, no hidden fees, and no gotchas. Thanks to SimpliSafe, fear has no place in a place like home. Try SimpliSafe with free shipping and free returns. You'll get a 60-day risk-free trial, too. Order now and have your home protected within a week. Go to simplisafe.com/politics to get started today. Be sure to go there so they know we sent you. It's SimpliSafe, SimpliSafe.com/politics. Let's delve into the politics of all of this. And I'll just say that before we found out that Mueller had submitted his report on Friday, we were actually planning on talking about Trump's reelection odds at this point today. So maybe let's kind of bluntly begin there. What effect does Barr's letter have on Trump's reelection odds, if any?
It makes them higher. I mean, I think it makes them higher in like a slightly funny way where like I think there has always been kind of the base case with Trump where his approval rating is in the low 40s. We'll see if this lifts it from 41, 42 to 43, 44, which actually would be kind of meaningful. But leaving that relatively minor potential for a shift aside, it's always like, okay, here's the base case where we can debate what the base case means. I think our rough feeling is that a base case is roughly a 50-50 proposition for Trump. But there are these downside scenarios where the economy goes south and or the Mueller report comes in really bad for him, and then he's in deep trouble. So you're talking about a landslide or a case where he might not stand for reelection at all.
So does this get rid of those latter two possibilities?
It has nothing to do with the economy, right?
Or yeah, I mean, no, as I mean, far as either getting a real primary challenger, losing in a landslide.
Again, like if we go into a recession starting tomorrow, then those things could happen. I mean, so it both removes this Russia coordination charge as a way that could undermine his presidency. And it also, I think, insulates him from further investigations, that there's more of a deterrent now based on, hey, this last one didn't really turn up anything. The public's going to be less tolerant of it. He can claim something is a witch hunt. Maybe in a perverse way, you don't want Democrats, if you're a Democrat, investigating all this stuff because it's not what the public cares about. And so maybe that deterrent could ironically have some unhelpful effects in terms of allowing Democrats to focus on other types of arguments that people are more concerned with. But for sure, you know, betting markets, the Scottish teens had imputed something like a 30% chance that Trump didn't even stand for re-election until fairly recently, which I think we've said always seemed a little bit high. And that chance, I think, now is quite a bit lower. I mean, the campaign for 2020, obviously, we talk about it every week here, has begun already. More the Democrats part of that campaign than Trump's campaign. But the scenario where Trump is brought down by a scandal is obviously, at least in the first term, much less likely now.
I do think if I wanted to be really cute, and I don't want to be this cute, but I would
say... But you're
going to
go ahead and say it anyway?
But I'm just going to throw it out there.
Go be cute.
That was my cute face.
That nobody could see because you're on the radio.
You can just imagine it, listeners. It was very...
It was cute.
In a weird way, you could say this like kind of helps Democrats. Like,
Wrong take.
Hear me out. First of all, Nick, you just made this point. I'm just elaborating on it.
Well, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Actually. But, you know, Pelosi was like sort of fending off pressure in her party to begin impeachment proceedings against Trump. I think barring something really, really smoking gunny coming out of Mueller, I think impeachment proceedings are probably going to hurt Democrats' chances in 2020. And now I think Pelosi will probably have an easier time fending off that pressure.
It's a very, very roundabout way of seeing an upside for Democrats.
No. If this means that Democrats now are more likely to fight 2020 on health care, on inequality, then like that, even before we got the Mueller report, I think we said on this podcast multiple times, is a better strategy for them. So like this sort of clarifies things. And if you're a Democratic operative, this kind of makes your life easier. Again,
maybe there is an in-between where like if Mueller had given the Democrats like 15% more ammunition,
yeah,
then it would be worse because it still wouldn't persuade the public. But like, but I think it would have been better if like he had given them lots of ammunition for Democrats, right? And so, you know, maybe there's like a little bit of a U-shaped curve or something where like this might be enough of a deterrent. You can say that I think a problem that Clinton had against Trump is that there were so many kind of threads to pull on that you weren't quite sure which one it would be. And so maybe kind of in some ways, treating Trump as a quote unquote generic Republican, because a lot of what the Republican Party stands for is not very popular either, might be a perfectly effective strategy because people do in this background think of Trump as being dishonest. About half of Americans, if they're asked, say, yes, we think President Trump actually is racist if you ask him that poll question. You know, I don't think if the public thinks that he had nothing at all to do that's shady with foreign powers or whatever else. And so in some sense, all that stuff's in the background, and that is why Trump's approval rating is 41%. Let's say it goes up to 43, 44. Seems very plausible to me. I don't know.
I mean, speaking of those numbers, Claire, you've been studying a bit of how Trump's skeptical Republicans view his administration and how they're reacting to his, you know, time in office so far. I mean, do you see this changing his standing with Republicans who don't particularly like Trump?
Well, I think those people are going to vote for him anyway. I mean, we saw that in the last election, that they might not like individual things that Trump does, and perhaps they'll vote for other people down ticket, say, in a midterm election. But I think ultimately a lot of those people would probably, not knowing who the Democratic nominee is yet or who a major third party candidate might be, I think those people would probably still vote for Trump. I mean, if we've learned anything in the past 2 years, it's that partisanship is pervasive in American life and that people vote for their team. And so, yeah, I think this gives credence to the idea of like, listen, let's wash our hands of this. This chapter is over. He didn't do anything with the Russians. Let's get on to the election and go on the merits of what's happening in American life.
Do you guys think the political fallout would be different? Let's imagine a world where what if Mueller waited to unveil all of the indictments until yesterday? Like it all came at once. How do you think the media would have covered the Mueller report?
Very, very differently, obviously. And the fact that it is kind of this slow burn and this stuff builds up, and how many people were indicted? Like 30-something, of whom 7 are Americans. Now, it is true that if you looked at those indictments as they came out one by one, I think in each case, people are kind of looking for, is there a smoking gun that ties Trump or someone very, very close to Trump to Russia over this kind of hacking stuff? And it seemed like there often wasn't really something that tied Trump or individual A, you know? I mean, what is kind of weird is like, if you just kind of took everything at face value, then the conclusion that Mueller has, or apparently has per Barr, is kind of what you should have expected based on the sum total of 2+ years worth of reporting.
Mike, as you mentioned, Nancy Pelosi has been trying to pull back on any pressure to start impeachment proceedings. But I mean, in general, you've heard Democrats talk about the chance of collusion. That's been the focus whenever people are talking about the Mueller investigation. So did Democrats miss the mark by focusing more on that chance of collusion as opposed to just Trump's general soft stance on Russia, knowing what we know about what Russia did in trying to interfere in the 2016 election? I mean, was that like a bad political decision?
Yeah. In fact, I think I've said that on this podcast like multiple times. I always thought they should have treated Mueller as gravy, as sort of beside the point, and anything that comes out of that will be extra. Because like, first of all, there's, from a Democratic point of view, plenty of other stuff to go after Trump on. To take just one example, what you said, you could say, you don't have to say anything about collusion to say, hey, Russia interfered in our election to help Trump. Mueller found that. We knew that before. That's kind of beyond a shadow of a doubt at this point. And Trump is soft on Russia.
It's an interesting point. But in some ways, you know, is it inevitable that the Democratic line would have to cede to the sort of prurient interest of the public in the Mueller investigation? That it's something that was being stoked in cable news talk shows, that it was something that people wanted to talk about, was the president a foreign agent, and that inevitably the crush of American culture would find its way to American politics, and that the party officials would inevitably turn to this line.
Probably, yeah. But like, what?
It's the media's fault more than the Democrats.
It's not just media. It's like American voters being like, whoa, this
Manchurian
is kind of crazy.
Candidate.
Yeah.
But why did collusion become the thing?
Because it's such a part of our mythology and our movies, right? Like, what would happen if a foreign country influenced us, right? That is literally the plot line of movies about American politics. And I think people were fascinated by the idea that art could become life.
I guess I take like kind of a less poetic and more prosaic rationale for it, which is that it served a lot of people's interests. That it serves, on the one hand, Trump's interest to say, hey, the question is, did Trump directly collude with Russia over this hacked email stuff? And that was the single most important question. but maybe got elevated in importance relative to every other question. Meanwhile, on cable news, then you fill all the freaking airtime they have on cable news by having people kind of irresponsibly speculate about what might happen when there's not that much news in the story from day to day. And so you do have kind of mutually reinforcing ways that raise expectations. And I do think in terms of like, oh, who comes across looking smart here? Well, you know, I'm not sure if it's people who said that like, oh, look, Russia, they didn't even hack in the first place, right? And then kind of kept moving the goalpost in a certain direction where now it has to be this like big, spectacular smoking gun finding of collusion on this relatively narrow issue. But I don't know.
To be fair to the American public, there is still the Helsinki press conference between Trump and Putin.
Like, there's Trump Tower.
There are a lot of things that people aren't dumb. People don't just listen to what the talking heads tell them. There are some innately interesting things about this entire scandal.
I mean, remember, people forget that like cable news is a relatively niche product.
The highest rated shows get 2 million or less viewers a night.
Yeah, which is not nothing. Which is not nothing, but like cable news is a relatively
niche. But it's not a lot of people. It's not a lot of Americans. Product. I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah. And so like, you know, again, my bias is because like I just don't really watch cable news very often.
Nate's better than you guys.
Yeah, what? Don't virtue signal about not watching cable news.
I'm virtue signaling about not watching cable news. But to me, it's like the way that like the New York Times or the Washington Post handled the story seemed fairly proportionate to me. I don't know.
No, and I think Claire's totally right that part of the reason at least collusion became a thing is because Russia interfered in the election and Trump was behaving really oddly towards Russia.
And also, to back it even further up, I think Democrats wanted to believe that some deus ex machina force had elected Donald Trump and not their fellow Americans.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's like, I think that's kind of an underlying thing.
But those people who want to believe that can still believe it because Russia did interfere.
Of course, yes. Russia obviously interfered in the election, but also they would have done that anyway with whatever Republican candidate it was, and then Americans chose Donald Trump.
Right.
Yeah, and I do want to state again that I think the evidence that Russian interference was enough to swing the election is not particularly persuasive. And if you want to blame someone for that, then you could probably blame Mr. James Comey, who was tweeting contemplative photos over the weekend.
I think all of this, that photo was funny, but I think all of this is Democrats searching for an explanation. If you want to blame someone, first of all, why do you want to blame anybody? But if you want to blame someone, blame voters. Voters voted for Trump and put him in office.
As with all things, your problems follow you around, America, and sometimes you just have to look inward.
Look inward, people.
Caitlin.
What is a host to do with that?
The devil lies inside you.
Well, I mean, I guess I would just say that for a lot of people, it's not a devil at all.
Or blame the Electoral College.
But
that's what we're saying. We're saying
it lies within the American body politic. So yes, absolutely. Some people don't think it's a bad thing, but the people who are talking about it right here obviously think it's a bad thing.
I mean, I think kind of always hoping for the silver bullet versus the things that are kind of obvious, right? Pretty obviously, the Electoral College caused Trump to win when he would not have won if it were determined by popular vote. Pretty obviously, the Clinton email controversy and the Comey letter, at least if you read our analysis of it, had fairly big intangible impacts, which given the narrow margin Trump's win probably was enough to swing the election, right?
But my point is just people on the left, Democrats, liberals, searching for a silver bullet, I think that shows a certain misunderstanding of the body politic. That's all my point was. And that if this helps them get past that, I think that's ultimately helpful for their cause. But the idea that like Trump's election was exogenous to American politics, normal American politics, I think is wrong.
I guess Democrats are going to have to win the 2020 election the hard way.
What we're saying is
by actually winning an election.
Tune into 538 for the next year because now we're the news outlet with all your answers.
Now we don't have to cover this story.
All that Russia crap that hurts our traffic
is all electoral politics from here on out.
By the way, thank God for Amelia. We would not have been able to do.
Can we just give Amelia a round of applause?
Yeah. Yay.
I hope she's already drunk on a beach somewhere in California.
Me too.
And I think we are going to leave it there. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
What a wild ride.
What a wild ride. It's finally over. Micah, thank you.
It's not over. It's not over. We want to see the report. Okay, we got it, people.
All right, there's your caveat. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. I want to thank everyone who came out to our live show last week. It was a lot of fun. As you may have heard during that live show, we're going to be doing other live events around the country. I think we should be announcing our Texas dates and locations by the end of this week. So stay tuned. We look forward to seeing you live in person wherever we are around the country. Otherwise, you can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.